Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
The traditional representation of muscle contractions being this like triphasic thing where there's an eccentric contraction, a concentric contraction, and then this isometric in the middle where you're holding things. Where what we're trying to do is there is really no stopping a movement. You're always in movement. If you're alive, you're always
If you're breathing,
you're always moving.
Correct.
If you're not breathing and you're cold and you're dead,
hang on. Somebody's going to go, but what if you're holding your breath?
Right.
Well, your heart's beating.
Yeah. You're still, there's still an expansion.
There's still circulation. There's still a lot of stuff that's going on. Yeah. So you can't really stop moving.
Sure. But, in the presence of a gradient, there's always movement.
Yeah. The premise being that the whole, like using the term isometric, same length, right? That's what that means.
Right.
From the visual, it would appear that that is the case. And I think that's why it still hangs around. I use the word static because I'm looking at trying to hold on to a position, right? I think it's a better representation because the thing that you run into when you start looking at what is actually happening from at the muscle level, the rule, if there is one, is non-uniformity, right? So the longer, let's just say that you're holding a static position and then the implication here is that, okay, the muscle's not moving. Well, first of all, it is, okay, especially the longer you stay there because you get connective tissue behaviors that are going to go through a stress relaxation, which means that the muscle's actually becoming more concentric in that circumstance. Because it's the connective tissue is allowing that to happen. But if you looked at it at the fascicular level or the motor unit level, the same motor units are not active throughout the whole period that you're holding the static position.
Right.
So some are turning on, some are turning off. And then there's a certain amount that would be required to maintain some representation of a static position. So if it's non-uniform and you don't even have the same muscle activity throughout, it's technically, I mean, I think it's almost absolutely that it's not the same length. It's like, you can't really, it's not appropriate to refer to it as isometric. And I don't care if you do or not. I know what you mean because, you know, we've spoken this language for a really long time. I just don't think that it's coherent with what we're observing at the muscle level.
Right. It's more like it just hold.
Yeah.
You're just holding, like you're static. Holding a position. And in a lot of cases, you're either holding against something that's winning and you're yielding to it, or you're pressing into something and overcoming. So there's the whole idea of like a yielding isometric or an overcoming isometric.
I mean, so we're running into a time dependent phenomenon. So even if my intention is to create an overcoming representation of connective tissue behavior, so I am pushing against an immovable object, if I can hold it long enough, there will be a connective tissue behavior change. So you have to account for that. And that's, I don't know, ballpark estimate 20 seconds in, you would see a representation of changes in the connective tissue behavior. Therefore, the muscle activity would have to change to hold a static position.
Yeah. And then also considering that, like, when you're at the bottom of, when you're at the end or the turnaround or transition point of any movement and you pause, there's still stretch shortening may potentially last. The stretch shortening cycle may potentially last for like 10 seconds. So you can come back from it.
Okay. So I believe it was Greg Wilson out of Australia that did the measurement on a bench press on average, I believe it was four seconds.
Okay.
I'm with you. I don't think it's like a standard. I don't think it'd be a standard number. I think there's going to be multifactorial influences associated with like, okay, well, how fast did you go into it? How much load is there? Right. So, you have other rate dependent phenomenon that are going to influence what, what is represented in the outcome, right? It's like, how much energy are you storing? How much energy are you releasing under those circumstances? But it, like I said, and I don't really care what terminology anybody uses, because I do understand what you're saying. I just avoid it because the goal is to be as coherent as possible. And if the assumption is like, oh, it's the same length, and then it's not, it's like, well, okay, then what is it? Right. And then we have to learn something, which I find value in. It's like, I actually can understand more about what is happening versus my assumption is that somebody told me that the muscle is not changing length, so it's not changing length. It's like, well, what's your evidence for that? And then the evidence is more favorable. It's like, oh, there's like this constant flickering on and off of motor units. There's changes in connectors. It's more fascinating to me to look at this thing and say, okay, when I'm trying to hold position, what other cool stuff is happening? And then especially kind of like you said before, it's like, well, if you're a living, breathing human being, it's like, good luck trying to hold still.
Yeah. So I'm going to try to approach this from the traditional perspective of isometrics, as far as I know. So utilizing it at certain ranges of motion to recruit motor units, rate coding is a word is a term that gets thrown around when it comes to isometric research, time under tension increase. What are the other things?
But that's not a useful measurement at all.
Sure. I'm just talking about the things that are typically mentioned as the benefits of isometric training. Then there's the whole potential carryover of training at different joint positions, and then having there be some carryover in strength. I'm making air quotes here for anyone listening.
I understand.
30 degrees above and 30 degrees below that angle that you're holding that isometric, you're getting some carryover. That's what they're saying it is happening.
I think you're giving them way too much credit, but okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to mention the things that have been
No, I'm with you.
I'm trying to think of other.
Yeah, the plus or minus is always interesting.
Yeah, and there's like the other perspective of, well, thinking about it from an athletic perspective, going into the cut and coming out of the cut, having that transition point from eccentric to concentric, other people traditionally thinking that that point is isometric, completely isometric, where everything is the same. And then, and it's not that, more about thinking about that from like a perspective of compression and internal rotation and stopping forward motion, but that's still not isometric. That's just like orthogonal, right?
Well, yeah, it's like you're approaching a point where there will be no movement.
Happens
in a split second, but holding a position implying that if I hold this position and then I approach this position dynamically and come out of that same position dynamically, it's the same as sitting there and holding it and therefore will benefit from it. That's hogwash.
Hogwash. Let's expand on that, why that is indeed hogwash, washing of pigs.
Because the muscle orientation is not the same. The connective tissue behavior is not the same.
Right.
Because again, you have rate dependent phenomena that are associated with connective tissue behaviors. You have the accumulation. And so you literally need a collision to get the reproduction of the dynamic, and holding the static position is not representative of the same mechanics. It's like the way that the energy is transferred is not the same. The way that the connective tissue behavior behaves is not the same, not even remotely, right? It's different. So again, if you're hoping, like, let's just say that you're working on a 5-10-5 and your cut out of your right foot is just sucky, right? And so you go, okay, I'm going to assume a position that approximates this right foot cut, and I'm just going to practice holding this position, right? I gradually over time will increase the magnitude of load in that circumstance, and therefore I have demonstrated some measure of progress in my ability to hold this under resistance. But you don't address the connective tissue behavior. Right now, if you want to tell me that you got a shape that you're trying to work on, and you can understand that the amount of time that you would spend in that position would be limited purposefully, so you wouldn't get some of the shape changing phenomenon that would be associated with a prolonged hold, it's like, we can have that conversation, but but to look at it as being the same, it can't be the same. There might be elements of it that would be useful. Okay, I'm cool with that, but don't think that it's the same. Because there's too much stuff that's happening before, there's too much stuff that's happening after, and then there might be like a couple of elements that would be useful in that circumstance.
So let's talk specifically about that transition from into the cut to mm-hmm. out of the cut, that point mm-hmm. in which like there is that instant where I get that collision and that connective tissue behavior. Mm-hmm. What is happening there versus the hold, like someone doing like the someone holding at the bottom of a goblet squat to try to work mm-hmm. on the transition from into and out of the cut versus someone like versus what's actually happening when they cut?
Well, okay, so if you were to statically hold any position that would have any tension on connective tissue behavior, you hold it long enough, you're going to see this expression of stress relaxation.
Yeah.
Right. So the connective tissue is telescoping itself, right, into a longer position. So if that connective tissue is actually attached to a muscle, that would imply that if I'm holding this static position, then that muscle is shortening. And then there would be a rate that would be associated with that connective tissue behavior. Like how fast is it happening?
Right.
Right. And then there would be an element of stiffness that would be associated with that connective tissue behavior as well. So how much energy it is capable of storing, or is it dissipating energy under that circumstance? And in the prolonged hold, energy is like you would lose energy most likely as heat in that circumstance. Yeah. And again, it doesn't make it not useful at all. It just means that what we're trying to do is relate it to something a little bit more specific. So as I enter a cut, if I could hit the exact same position, the rate at which I enter that position, the connective tissue behavior is different. It's actually stiffer. It will not yield in the same way that I would see a prolonged hold behave, right? So the energy storage actually could be significantly greater because as I do that at a higher rate, the stiffness of that connective tissue is actually greater, right? And if I can deform it, I can store a lot more energy in that. And then we think about like, okay, if I'm going to come out of this cut, it's like there's the storage and release phenomenon that is not expressed in the static hold where the energy would be dissipated. I'm actually storing this and releasing it to a greater degree. There's still going to be some that's going to be released as heat. But from an application standpoint, it's like there is a greater energy return in that circumstance because of the rate-dependent change in the connective tissues. But from a muscle activity standpoint, I still have a high degree of concentric orientation. Chances are, as I enter that, because of the force application into the ground, I'll most likely be able to recruit more motor units in the actual change of direction versus something that would be a static hold where I would be selectively activating and deactivating motor units based on the traditional perspective of the pattern of recruitment. So you would say, well, the lower threshold motor units, the lower cross-sectional area would be recruited first, and then whatever the force application into the ground that would be required would determine like how much or how large the motor units are, whether you're more fast twitch versus slow twitch kind of a thing.
Right. So if someone was trying to train in a way to improve the change of direction and that transition, make a sharper transition from into to out of the cut.
Yeah.
They could, using a hold might be a beneficial thing from a perspective of like center of gravity management, position against gravity, like being able to acquire that position, that change of direction position. And sort of mm-hmm. practice being in that position, I guess. But when it comes to like, yeah, when it comes to the connective tissue behavior that you're wanting to use, it would be more beneficial to do something like oscillatory, like a drop and catch type of thing to get the rate, to have the rate yes, be more absolutely. Appropriate.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like you're going to approach reality to a much greater degree by using some sort of like short impulsive activity.
Impulsive, yeah. Uh-huh. So like what I'm comparing here would be someone holding the bottom of a, so if I put a bar into a rack and I get into a low split stance position and I just push up into the bar, it's an immovable object and I'm just pushing as hard as I can in that split position. Mm-hmm. And thinking that's going to translate to my change of direction because I'm approaching certain angles that are biomechanically similar, whatever we want to talk about when it comes to dynamic correspondence to the activity. But what would be more beneficial would be to get into like a higher split stance, drop into that lower split stance position and catch and hit the brakes. And then come out of it, because that's going to be more similar to the muscular and connective tissue action of actually changing direction versus me pressing into an immovable object.
Right. Now, let's consider the beneficial element of what you just described.
Right.
There is a position, like a skeletal position and a muscle orientation that it may approximate to a sufficient degree that it would contribute to performance. It's, we just can't equate that behavior to the thing, right? Yeah. There is an element of it that could be useful. So for instance, it's like, if you have trouble acquiring the position itself, then it could potentially be useful, right? Now the concern that you have is, how did you acquire said position? Because we may not actually know that.
Right? Yeah,
you might be creating like a compensatory shape change to allow you to approximate whatever that might be. So narrow ISA versus wide ISA, who's going to be better at the point of change of direction? Well, your wide ISAs are going to be better by far as a natural phenomenon of structure. Right? Like their structure is ideal for that. Doesn't mean that you can't be fast in change of direction, you know, as a narrow. It just means like the way that you're going to do it is probably going to require some higher form of compensatory activity to produce the downforce. That's all.
Yeah. And also like still staying on that topic of shape change and the shape that you need to acquire to change direction. When you're just coaching someone in change of direction or you're practicing change of direction, it happens so fast that if you aren't technically proficient in the movement or coaching of that movement, you might not see what's happening. But if I put you under a bar that's immovable for 5 seconds, I have 5 seconds to watch how you're pushing into the ground, how you're organizing your upper body, what position your lower leg is in, what position your upper body is in. So I can coach you to get into that transition position mm-hmm. and shape maybe a little mm-hmm. bit better. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily the isometric that is contributing to your improvement in the technique of the change of direction, but it's mm-hmm. probably that like I caught that you were pushing through the outside of your foot and I had mm-hmm. you push through the inside of your foot with the bar there. And I brought your weight back to your heel a little bit because you were too far into your toes or something like that, or too much of a side bend or whatever sure. it might be. And that change of position and pressure mm-hmm. management was what allowed me to have a better result in my cutting yeah. drill. And that's not exactly what's happening. I'm just giving an example of what yeah. you would call like a counterfactual right. reason for something right. working. Right. Right. So you mentioned something about like wides and narrows. And I think maybe like when we talk, let's talk about statics and holding positions. Now that we've talked about the traditional perspective, we've talked about what we're asking everyone to reconsider. And now we're going to talk about from the UHPC model perspective. Mm-hmm. How would I utilize, or how do you utilize statics for like wides or narrows in different, this will give some examples, I guess.
So the reason that you would use like a static position of any kind
yeah.
it's kind of like what I was saying before. It's like you're trying to promote a physical shape that allows either an access to space or an application of force in a specific manner. So there's an ER and an IR superimposed throughout all of our movement, assuming that we're in contact in this case with the ground. Right. So we have a a space that ER provides, and then we have a downforce that IR provides. And so if I need to teach somebody how to access a space and then apply a force into the ground, it behooves me to do it in a very slow and controlled manner so that they have a representation for which to compare. Like they have to learn, you know, what sensation am I chasing? What does this feel like? Do I even have the capacity to do so? And much to what you were describing before, is like, it's also evaluative for the coach and the observer, is like, I can use any movement or any position as an assessment tool and comparator to determine whether this person actually has access to these spaces and the capacity to push down without a compensatory strategy. Yeah. And so it just becomes like every static position that we use is like, as you're moving through space, there will be moments in time where you are a certain shape, and then there's an activity that would be associated with that. Right. And so all I'm trying to do is approximate that shape. Like, there's the, for me, that's the benefit of anything that you're doing statically, is like, can I approach the appropriate shape? Right. It's not about holding it for any particular length of time other than to learn the muscle orientation and general position. Then I want everything to be dynamic. Like, in a perfect world, I wouldn't want to use static activities because, again, we don't really behave that way.
Right.
Yeah. But from a learning tool, right, to give you opportunities to make a change and a comparison, because it helps you visually as the coach. It helps them internally. You know, if you read anything, was it Wolf, the internal external cue?
Person? Gabriel Wolf. Yeah, the cueing stuff.
Yeah, it's like, so you want the athlete, the client, whomever, to develop this internal vocabulary of oh, this is what it's supposed to feel like as I move through space, so they can start to compare themselves. Just like learning any new skill, it gives them an opportunity.
Yeah,
to make self adjustments once they understand what it is that they're supposed to be doing.
Right. So yeah, if I'm trying to give someone better control, like relative joint control of their knee, and I want them to, you know, I want them to make sure they're capturing foot contacts, they're feeling like VM working, they're feeling their anterior tib working as they pull themselves out over their foot. If I can utilize a hold, that gives them time and it gives me time to see what's happening over the course of, you know, 3 to 5 seconds, multiple right. times. And then I can yeah. see what happens when they fatigue as well. Like, what are their mm-hmm. tendencies when they fatigue? Yeah. Like, how do they shift their center of gravity then? I wanted to try to give like some more specific examples. So I know that we've utilized like a wall push, or like a push down into like in a half kneeling position, pushing into a wall, or like uh-huh. in a half kneeling position, like pushing down into a yoga block or something that's on yeah. your side. Like, yeah. I think that would be like an example of a static that you could use. Uh-huh. Maybe get into why you would do something like
okay,
that.
Okay. So this goes back to shape and muscle orientation.
Right.
Right. To give you a, for instance, so if you're in half kneeling, you're going to approximate 90 degree angles, which would be a very orthogonal relationship, which demands a strong representation of internal rotation. So as there's a like an exhalation based shape of the pelvis that would be biased towards IR. There would be hip positions that would be biased towards IR. So anytime you approximate a zero in a 90 degree angle, you're going to be more strongly representing internal rotation demand. And so like a half kneeling position. And if you're trying to learn how to manage the muscle orientations of the pressure that would be associated with this. So it's an exhalation based strategy. So you have an outlet that's trying to stop. You have a thoracic diaphragm position that is actually inhaled, pushing against a closed glottis in many circumstances. And so if you want to teach somebody to not over exhale, these we were talking about this before we came on. Mm-hmm. It's like this is actually a really good exercise for that, because the amount of pressure that needs to be created, if you over exhale, you can no longer produce force through the extremity. It's like it actually reduces it. And so you can actually feel when you exhale too hard. So anytime you push into the ground, you know, where you're superimposing the IR or you're pushing through the extremity, like I said, it's a dead giveaway for when you're not maintaining the muscle orientation that you would utilize to produce force in that position.
Right.
So very handy. Yeah.
Right. And you can vary where you're putting force down. So like if I'm in a half kneeling position and I'm pushing down on the inside against Correct. The yoga block, that would be more of like an into the cut.
Depends on which side you're pushing on, actually.
So if
you're
right
inside the base of support,
inside the base of support.
Yes. If your contact is inside the base of support. So here you are, you're in half kneeling and you're pushing down into the ground inside of the base of support. You would be on the into the cut side of the behavior. If you're pushing down on the outside, that's going to be an ER bias, which is actually going to push you away from the ground contact, which would be much more like coming out of the cut.
Right.
So to give you a frame of reference.
Okay. And then pushing down into both would be just trying to come to a stop.
Dead stop.
Dead stop position.
Yeah. Cause you're taking the turns out. Like basically the reason, like a one hand contact, creating pressure from a half kneeling position is always going to produce the element of turn, right? A double hand contact cancels out the directionality. So you're turning both hands in, both hands out sort of at the same time. Therefore there is no turn.
Right.
Yeah. But again, we're not trying to equate this to the dynamic activity of cutting per se. What we're trying to acquire is a shape, a physical shape that we would use. Because we're certainly not cueing the connective tissue behaviors. We're certainly not cueing the degree, if you will, of muscle orientation. Right.
Similar, useful, but only useful
at certain times.
I'd say like, taking the two examples that we've mentioned so far. So if I'm in a split squat position, pushing up into a bar that's immovable, like I'm mm-hmm. pushing into a rack that's bolted uh-huh. to the ground versus me in half kneeling, pushing down into yoga blocks, the latter is probably the safer to fail version of trying to acquire a position.
Oh, you have so much more control over the force application and position. Sure.
Yeah. And then not having to, you know, because I can push into that bar as hard as I can with having like a really big ER orientation through my lower body, outsides of the feet.
Sure.
ERing hard, pushing, not really like accomplishing what I would want, using the muscles in a way that would even be relevant to how I would want to use them on the field. And mm-hmm. even to go farther to say like I would never want to use them in that way on the field, and that might lead to me injuring myself mm-hmm. If I am trying to cut on the outsides of my feet with you know, in an oriented position. I think we sort of accomplished what we were trying to accomplish with the whole isometric thing.
Let's say it's like, you know, overall point here is that like static representations are not useless. We just have to understand like how they would contribute to the behavior, and then, but using it as a representation of a muscle contraction in and of itself, it's like, don't look at it from that perspective.
Right. Right. Right.
Yeah. Not a big fan of the concentric and eccentric contraction element. Position wise, yes.
Right.
You know, eccentric means away from midline.
Yeah. Right?
Eccentric contraction means to shorten.
Well, isn't the actual term, the terminology is actually isometric, isometric, myometric, and eccentric, or what are the three metrics? It's isometric, myometric, and I can't remember. I
don't know. There's oxytonic, which would be a dynamic representation of muscle activity. You have the isotonic, which is same tone, which again, that doesn't make sense to me.
Right. Isokinetic, isotonic. Yeah.
Yeah. Isokinetic is just, it's a fixed velocity. Right. But again, it's like, that's the external representation. It doesn't measure the internal behavior.
Right.
Right. Which could be different.
So. Did we talk about this is Halloween. We're doing this on Halloween. So did we talk about candy? Have we talked about candy yet?
Like favorite Halloween candy? Yeah. Somebody brought that up recently. Was that on like a,
I can't remember. It's just,
that might've been office hours. That might've been office hours on the network.
Oh yeah. Maybe that's what it was.
We can blame Dale. Dale's listening to this right now. So we can blame Dale for that. Yeah.
So I want to know what, as a kid, your favorite. Not now. I don't want to know about now. Candy now is whatever. But like growing up, like what was your favorite Halloween candy or treat as a kid?
Anything with sugar in it when I was a kid, except for
candy corn.
That was like, that's like a one in time thing. Those have always been like one of the greatest inventions. I mean, like, yeah, went to the moon in 1969. That was pretty impressive. But it's still like it is beyond me how that little perfect candy can be constructed the way it is. And then who's the guy with the little stencil that writes on every single piece of that candy? It's an amazing phenomenon.
I would always try to hit the houses that gave out money. There was always some rich people in the neighborhood that would just give.
Back in the olden days, before the kids that are listening to this were born, people actually used to give full size candy bars.
Yeah.
Not these little fun. Like, there's no such thing as a fun size candy bar. The fun size is the full size.
Yeah, that's the trick.
Like, yeah, give me a full size two rights Twix bar. Like that would be like the best. That'd be the best one.